Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And it's Thanksgiving week, and boy, do we have a special guest today. His name is Nelson DeMille. And you've all heard the name. We've all enjoyed his books for so many years. It's incredible. His new book is called The Panther, and it is just out from Grand Central, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
David, good morning.
It is such a pleasure to talk to you. I can't believe I'm really talking to you. You're just such a tremendous writer.
Thank you so much. It's very kind of you.
You take years to write a book, which I am very appreciative of, because you do a lot of research.
Yeah, you know, a lot of authors are coming out once a year, some couple of times a year.
Yeah.
But I write the old-fashioned way. I do my own research, and I do my own writing, which is not what everybody does these days. And also, you know, I just take time with it. I mean, I think each book should be kind of an event book. A book a year may be good. I mean, there are writers who can do it. Don't get me wrong. Stephen King is a genius, and he can write a book a year and
right.
off the top of his head. But for the rest of us, we need to, you know, kind of agonize over it a little bit, too, and do the research, get it right, and because your name is on it, you know, hopefully forever.
Now, have you ever been in Yemen?
No, I was going to go, David, but I was advised by the Department of Defense and also the State Department to have what they call warden messages on their website, and it never went from yellow to green, and now it's actually red, so not a place you want to be
right.
at my age anyway.
So one of the most fascinating things about this book is the descriptions of Yemen, and is that really the way it is right now today?
Pretty much. It's actually gotten worse. There was some news last night that, you know, there are terrorist attacks again in Yemen. I had friends who had been there, though. I had a friend with the Joint Terrorist Task Force that I represent in the book, who actually was down there in Aden, the port city, to investigate the USS Cole bombing. And I had a young friend who actually lived in Sana'a for a couple of months. But, you know, he was in his 20s, a master's degree, and immortal at that age. And I was in Vietnam for a year, and, you know, getting shot at gets old real fast. So.
Right.
I didn't need to do this.
I met you in Ridgewood, New Jersey, a number of years ago when you were at
right.
Bookends doing a signing. And what struck me about you was just what a nice guy you really are. I could tell by the way you were talking. I could tell by the way when I said hello to you, and that you're just such a nice guy. I mean, you're just very, very down to earth, and very easy to talk to. And for somebody who's a fan, you know, that's so wonderful. I mean, I traveled 2.5 hours to see you.
I know. That's always a good starting in Ridgewood at Bookends. It's always a friendly crowd and a bright crowd. I mean, they're there, you know, to see the author. I'm not always so friendly, by the way, but
no.
You know, you're with your readers, and they're there to see you, and you're gonna give them all the courtesy they deserve, as opposed to, you know, other celebrities who are in the performing arts, let's say, rock stars. I mean, writers are not rock stars. They're regular people for the most part. Some of them can be arrogant. We know that. And,
mm-hmm.
Most of them. I mean, at least the ones I hang around with, you know, the Harlan Cobens and Mary Higgins Clark and Carol Higgins Clark. These are good people who respect their readers.
Oh, I know. I know. I've met them. I know. You're exactly right there. It's over 600 pages, but it never feels that way with you, because we always trust that we're in good hands with a great storyteller. I mean, and you are a great storyteller. I mean, all the books that you've written, I mean, I go back and I think about them, and I think how wonderful they really are, and how much everybody's enjoyed them.
Yeah, they tend to be long. And I have a good publisher who doesn't mind the length. Some publishers mind the length for, you know, obviously economic reasons, let's say. But, the books years ago used to be long, when books were, you know, a primary form of entertainment for so many of us. And the old Michener books that were so well-researched, I still write in that vein. I'm not that old, but I think I grew up that way with the longish book. And, you know, Gone with the Wind to me was just fine length, and so was War and Peace. So, and the people who enjoy the long books, enjoy my writing for that reason, and I try to parse it out so right, it doesn't seem long, but it is long.
What strikes me about this book in particular is John Corey's sense of humor. He's very sarcastic in this book.
Yeah, he's always been a little bit of a sarcastic guy, but I think that's just NYPD cop mouth, if you know what I mean. He's on the Joint Terrorist Task Force working for the FBI, but he's not about to change his ways. I think that's what gives the book some oomph, that he deals with State Department people, FBI, and other federal employees who are somewhat politically correct, a little bit more maybe polished than he is. And he's just a rough guy from the streets, but he gets the job done.
But it seems like the way he sarcastic, the way he tells jokes, in serious situations, seems to be his way of dealing with serious situations.
Yeah, you know, I see that with NYPD, and I picked this up in the Army. You know, we all saw the movie Platoon, and Oliver Stone was in Vietnam, and he was in combat, like, as I was. But the one thing he got wrong with Platoon was he forgot the GI humor, and this is so much part of the bad experience. It's, you know, gallows humor, if you will, dark humor. You're getting shot at, and you got to make a joke. And the NYPD, and most municipal police forces, I think, are the same way. This is what I try to bring out with Corey. I mean, right, he deals with it by making a joke of it, and I think it's very effective and good for the reader.
Yeah, and he sort of embarrasses Kate in a lot of instances, too.
Oh, maybe we all embarrass our wives.
Yeah, but it's true, and I think a lot of people enjoy embarrassing their wives to a certain extent. I mean, it's fun. It's fun. Life is supposed to be fun.
Yeah, and he gets kicks under the table, but she represents that other world of the politically correct FBI. She's FBI special agent, and she's in a career track. And marrying him was not good for her career, but you know, she loves him and he loves her, and they make a good couple in fiction form, because I think so many of us could relate to that.
So, do you do how much research do you do before you write a book? When you actually sat down to write The Panther, how much research had you done before? I mean, are we talking months and months and months of research?
Oh yeah, months and months and months. And you know, I usually do the research in three parts. One is to go to the place that I'm writing about. I did not do that in this case, but I had, you know, Google and Global Search and that type of thing. The other is I talk to people who've been either in the occupations that I'm representing or have actually been to the place. And then you do the book research, which today is less book and more internet. And you put it all together, and you know, not only do you want to get it right, but the research really gives you some plot angles, things, you know, that you never would have thought of, because truth is stranger than fiction. And when I was speaking to one guy had been there with the Joint Terrorist Task Force, he told me about this State Department program that you have to take a course before you go. It's a small, 4 or 6 hour course on Yemen. And, you know, I just kind of forgot about it. Then when I was writing the book, I said, this would be a good way to introduce the reader to Yemen in New York before we get to Yemen. And I made it into a kind of a funny thing where Buckminster Harris, old State Department WASP guy, is briefing John Corey and his wife. And it was a good device, but I never would have thought of it. So you got to do your research, because no matter how good an imagination you have, you're not going to imagine things that are, you know, that are real, and that could be really not only important for the book, but entertaining to the reader.
And it's funny, because a lot of these characters, I mean, John Corey doesn't have time for some of them, and we get that impression pretty quickly when the character appears, and John, you know, you can tell John's a bit upset by the way they act, and he just doesn't have much time for them. But that creates a sense of humor. I mean, it's funny, almost, to read it, because we realize that John doesn't have time for fools.
Right, and I think, you know, as he is at NYPD, you know, to be a cop is, you know, self-selecting. How many people want to be cops? I don't want to be a cop. I wasn't that way when I was a kid. A lot of, you know, kids say they want to be police, and when they get older, they don't want to. But people go on to into the police force or go into the military, as I did, are kind of self-selecting. And the personality is already there, and you already understand the culture and the subculture that you're dealing with, and that's going to form you for the rest of your life. And I think he's a good character. We've seen so many books with cops in it, but it's rare that you get him in a situation like this, where he's dealing with the FBI, dealing with CIA, and he's kind of, in some ways he's over his head, we know that, but he's not really over his head. He knows who he is, and he knows how to get the job done, and everybody else is sort of process-oriented, where he's goal-oriented.
And you also bring in another character from some of your other books, Paul Brenner.
Right.
To be a kind of a foil to him, too, a very knowledgeable guy, and it's interesting the way you do it. Have you ever done that, have two of your separate characters in one book like this?
Is
this?
No, not really. I get so many fan mails, you know, through the website, emails, which is nelsonthebill.net, and they're asking to see Paul Brenner again. Paul Brenner was in General's Daughter, and he was played in the movie by John Travolta. actually did a good job.
Right.
Then I brought Paul Brenner back in Upcountry, and he's ex-Army CID, Criminal Investigation Division. And he's a good character. I like the character. I just didn't have a role for him. I didn't really want to do another whole sequel, although a lot of the fans wanted me to do that. But I decided, this is a job that would fit him, which is the State Department security in Yemen. And so I brought him back in that capacity. And it was a little bit challenging, David, because you have two alpha males in the same book. And John Corey is obviously the star of this book, but I didn't want to diminish Paul Brenner in the mind of the readers who like Paul Brenner.
They're and he's a very serious guy, too.
Yeah, he's a little more serious, although he's played a little bit differently by John Travolta, who had him a little bit of a wise guy. And he was a little bit of a wise guy in the first book, General's Daughter.
Which is a classic, yeah.
Thank you. That was a good movie. I was actually happy with the movie.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. I wonder, I mean, you've written a lot of successful books. You could retire anytime you want, but you still do this, and it's not easy work. So do you do it for the fun of it?
Well, that's a really good question. I ask that to other writers who I know could retire. James Patterson, who makes $20-25 million a year, and I say that because,
yeah,
you know, reported in, Wall Street Journal, for one. I don't know. To make an admission on the air, no, I cannot retire. I'm not in a position to retire. I have a 6-year-old and a new wife, so.
Oh, I didn't realize you had a 6-year-old. Wow.
Yeah, I have a new tax rate coming in 2013, so I don't think I can retire right away. I'm here. There's an old expression in the business. I don't like writing, but I like having written, and that's the way I always feel. I don't like the process particularly. It's very arduous, and you're kind of alone. You're socially isolated, and which is why I enjoy, you know, getting out to the bookstores, because it's, you know, you got real people in front of you, and when you're working, you know, as a writer, you're working by yourself, and you're working 8 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, and you're not seeing anybody. So I don't really enjoy the process anymore. But when it's done, even when a chapter is done, and I'm really happy with it, I'm happy I have written. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's very, very, what do you call it? It's not exactly instant gratification, but when you're done, it's very gratifying, especially if you've written a good book and people respond to it. And this book, you know, debuted at number one in the New York Times. So,
tell people about your military experience. I want to hear about it. It's fascinating.
Well, in 66, I left school. It was I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I left Hofstra University and the end of my senior year, actually, and I joined the United States Army. Before I joined, I took a battery of tests, and you know, I knew what I was fit for, which was many things, including to the Army. Anyway, long story short, I went through, you know, regular basic training and advanced infantry training, and then I went to infantry OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia, became a second lieutenant. Then I went to Panama for a while for training, jungle training, so I knew they weren't going to send me to Germany after the jungle training, but... And I trained troops, and then I was sent to Vietnam in November of 67, and I returned to the States in November of 68. And, I was there during the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Ashau Valley and the Battle of Khe Sanh. It was the most intense year there, 68, the year I was there. And it was a life-changing experience. I mean, leading men in combat and getting shot at is something that stays with you for a while, and some of my books reflect it. Word of Honor, for one, I guess Upcountry, another. But I didn't write about it exclusively, like some Vietnam vets have, like Tim O'Brien and Phil Caputo, who wrote great books. But there are other things I want to explore, and I think probably I wrote my last Vietnam novel.
Right. And I guess we're living part of your life when we're reading your books, too. I remember when I first read General's Daughter, how wonderfully it was written. What an enjoyable book to read. You really have a knack for the storytelling aspect. I mean, and what drives the Panther is knowing they're going to get to Yemen, and what's going to happen to them once they get to Yemen. Are they going to survive? I mean, are they even going to make it through Yemen?
Yeah, everybody's waiting for Kate Mayfield to die, John's wife.
Really?
There are a lot of women that don't like Kate Mayfield. It's funny. They want John to be single again. And but we're not going to kill the main character. I mean, that's the challenge, too, David. You know the main character's not going to die.
Right.
And yet you got to feel like he's in danger and he may die, or something terrible may happen to him. when you create, you know, any, I mean, it's a convention. It's a little bit, you know, formulaic, unfortunately, but the hero rarely dies in books and never dies in Hollywood, and yet you've got to put him in these dangerous situations. You have to create characters around him that are likable and believable that very well may die, and I think this is what the reader is, you know, holding his or her breath for and at the edge of his or her seat to see what exactly is going to happen.
Exactly, and that's what makes you turn the pages here, and it's quite enjoyable. It's like, what is going to happen? I mean, this is a very dangerous situation they're put in. And I even think to myself, why is Kate even going? For some reason, I always think of the woman being more fearful than the man, when actually she's pretty fearless herself.
Yeah, she's actually the prime mover here. She wants to go with John, who has been in Yemen for 40 days on an assignment, doesn't want to go back. That was kind of interesting, but she's career oriented, and she's, you know, she kind of believes in her government. She doesn't see the double crosses and the things behind the scenes that John sees, or at least suspects. So she again represents, you know, good people who, you know, on the front lines for us in the war on terrorism, and she's a little bit fearless too. Why I have no idea, but again, it's self-selecting. She's an FBI agent with a gun, and she knows what she's getting into. I took them off the streets of New York because all the other John Corey books are set in New York. I wanted to put them in a dangerous situation that was inherently dangerous from the minute they stepped off the plane. I think that worked, and that they were in a hostile environment, and they don't have all the resources they had when they were on the anti-terrorist task force in New York City.
I mean, you definitely know what you're doing with writing. You know, I mean, you read this book and it's very seamlessly written. I mean, there's nothing in there that where you say, well, you know, this is not realistic. Everything seems very realistic, down to the sarcasm and down to where they go and what's happening in the book. And we know it comes from you doing so much research. We know, well, yeah, we may have to wait a little while for another Nelson DeMille, but it's worth the wait. It's always been worth the wait.
Well, David, I wish you were my editor. I really my editor.
So the publishers are saying, write faster, and you're like, no, I want to do the right thing. I want to make the book perfect.
Yeah, the publishers want it faster. They want a book a year, and I know, you know, I have other co-authors and co-authors, but, you know, colleagues and my publishing company who do write faster, and they do get a book out a year. But, you know, my editor's a little bit tough, not as tough as you. Or maybe, you know, her toughness is what makes the book what it is, too. She likes cuts. She thought maybe John Corey's a little bit over the top with his sarcasm. And so, you know, it's another reality there. And I'm, you know, I've been in this business 35 years. This is my 17th book. But I tell you what, I do listen. I don't take everything everybody says as gospel in terms of the criticism. It starts with my assistant who types for me. And she puts in her opinion, and so does my wife, and then a few others read the book, and you can get a consensus. I don't like the book by consensus, it's still my book, but every once in a while somebody comes up with something, and I do listen, and it's also the fans, because with email now through the website, I get like 1,000 emails, and you can get a consensus. You could realize maybe you did go over the top with John Corey a little bit, if the majority of the people are saying that, or maybe some other scene, you know, wasn't necessary, but you know, that's people who are being maybe overly critical. You're supposed to read it for the enjoyment, and I think, you know, obviously most people enjoy it.
Yeah, the readers notice everything.
They do, don't they?
They do notice everything. You have to be on your toes all the time, so it must be difficult for you. You constantly have to be totally authentic with your books and totally make sure all the facts are correct. And let's face it, facts are, it's when you have a lot of facts, it's not easy to remember them.
No, you do have fact checkers. There is one mistake in this book. I put Dover Air Force Base in Maryland, where actually it's in Delaware.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't even notice.
Well, thank you. Good. I have about 100 fan letters so far telling me that I misplaced Dover Air Force Base, which is, you know, kind of a brainless thing. You know, I was obviously having maybe a late night, but you think that the fact checkers are going to... And I have a good fact checker too, but he slipped on on everybody who read it didn't see that. So, but my good fans did not miss it, and so for the paperback, we're going to put Dover Air Force Base back where it belongs.
Oh, good, that's great. Now, are we going to see other books with John Corey and other books with Paul Brenner? Are they going to be back again?
You know, David, I don't know about Paul Brenner. The jury's still out on Paul Brenner. doing, what I'm working on now is another John Corey book, and there's something in the FBI called the Hostage Rescue Team, HRT. It's kind of an elite unit that most people don't know about. No, very few people, they're very rarely used, but they rescue hostages, as the name suggests. They're mostly domestic when it comes to that, but they also do foreign hostage rescue, and they're sort of like a Delta team or Navy SEALs. And so John Corey, yes, is going to have and his wife Kate Mayfield are going to have an adventure with the hostage rescue team in a foreign country. It's going to be a little bit like the Panther, in that I'm going to set it in a very hostile environment, probably Afghanistan, although maybe Pakistan.
Will it be another animal title?
No, I'm done with it. I guess I'm ripping about the animal title.
When I first saw it, I said, oh no, he's going to do an animal each time, you know, it's going to be a different, which I don't mind. I could care. I know I'm going to get a good book, so I'm not worried about the title. I'm worried about anything. I know we're in good hands. We've always been in good hands with you.
Thanks. I don't know. I don't know how writers, some of them are geniuses. They can really write a book a year, a book 9 months. To me, I just kind of agonize over it. Maybe not agonize is the right word. I kind of polish and massage it. And every book, in the old days, writers used to write a book and put it in a drawer. I mean, let it sit and then take it out. You know that. I mean,
right.
Nobody took a book that was that fresh, like young wine or young cheese, and pawned it off on the public. It sat there because it'll percolate in your mind while it sits there for a month or two. Then you go back to it, read it fresh, and, you know, voila. I mean, you're getting a whole bunch of changes that are coming out of your subconscious that you knew needed to be done, but you couldn't do it while it was that fresh, while the ink was still wet. So, I mean, just that process alone takes time, and it's not like I'm talking to my editor now when I'm explaining why the book is late again, but maybe, you know, again, at my age, I'm not in any rush. I mean, the books are out there forever. The backlist does very well, too.
Oh, yeah.
The titles do well, and I think because the book is as good today as it was, you know, 20 years ago when I wrote it. I get so many fan letters from young readers who don't know the chronology and not paying attention, and they say something like, I just read your new book, By the Rivers of Babylon. Well, it was written in 1978, probably before people were born, but it still resonates to them. Gold Coast is another one. I mean, it's 20 years old, this book, and people are reading it today as though it was written yesterday, and it still sounds like a good book, and people who don't, you know, not paying attention to copyright dates, most people don't. I think they're reading a new book, and they're still enjoying it. So,
an
author lives on that way.
And that's the beauty, even after you're not around anymore, I'm not around anymore, your books are still going to be enjoyed.
We hope so. That's the goal. I have a 6-year-old heir who could probably benefit from a good active backlist.
You know how wonderful it is when I work in a bookstore. So when I take a customer over and just to look at your books, and I tell them which are my favorites. I mean, you're one of those authors that I can just go over and say, here, read this, because they're all great books. And it's such a privilege to be able to do that and to know that you've written these great books and that people will enjoy them when they sit down and read them.
And hopefully my 6-year-old, thank you for that. But I want my 6-year-old, my oldest children who are 32 and 34, read all my books, and they're brainy kind of kids. They both went to Ivy League schools, and they don't normally read popular fiction, but they love my books. So if I can reach, you know, that audience, and the demographics of my audience has amazed me sometimes. Men and women in their 80s, kids 17, 18 years old, upper class, lower class, the whole nine.
Everybody likes you.
Well, you know, tell a good story, and it's all about the story. If you're a storyteller, again, I go back to Stephen King. I think he's one of the geniuses of the
movie. Oh, he is.
If you know how to tell a story, you know how to tell a story, and hopefully you know how to write, too. And if you can't write that well, if you have a great editor, that's good too. But this all starts with the storytelling.
You're very. It's nice to hear you say that. Because I mean, you obviously know what you're doing. I mean, this is not something you can just sit down and do without a lot of thought and a lot of talent involved. And you have all of it. And I'm very jealous of you. In some ways.
Well, if you wanted to write a book, the advice I always give is take two aspirin, lay down in a dark room, and wait for the feeling to pass.
Well, really? Is that right?
It's not easy. I mean, would I have picked this life? Probably not, but I fell into it. And it's been a good life. I mean, I have no regrets. I enjoy my I don't enjoy the process, but I enjoy the life that goes along with it. And I just enjoy, you know, the fact that people respond so well to the books. Instead of, like, doing something you don't like to do, but you're doing it well. Robert Benchley was Peter Benchley's grandfather, I think.
Right, yeah.
But I don't like writing, but I'm too rich and famous to quit. So,
oh, that's funny. That's good. Do you read a lot? Do you read a lot of more nonfiction or fiction?
I read almost all nonfiction. I don't read fiction. It kind of throws me off. If I read fiction, it's, you know, the older stuff. I'll go back to a Somerset Maugham or something. But the new popular fiction, some of it's not good, as you know. Some of it is, you know, it's good, but it just kind of it throws me off a little bit. I don't want to, you know, be derivative, and I don't care who's writing about terrorism now, who's writing, you know, the action adventure novel. I mean, it would really probably interfere with my own writing. But I read so much nonfiction, probably, you know, for the research, but probably just for pleasure. I'm reading In the Garden of Beasts now by Austin. It's a great book. And I read Unbroken by Laura Hildenbrandt. And these are just great, great books. And I so respect nonfiction writers who can get into that kind of research and that kind of world 30 years ago and 50 years ago. And both these books are, you know, just named are both World War II era books. And I'm just amazed that they could recreate a world that's 60, 70 years old and hold my interest on every page. So I enjoy nonfiction, and I write fiction so other people can enjoy it.
Right. And you're very good at what you do. And I guess it's going to be a couple of years before we see a next book. But you know what? I don't care, because I know I'm going to get a great book. And we all know that. I mean, all your fans know that, because they trust you, and they know that you know what you're doing.
Well, thank you for that. And I think that maybe that is the word. I'm not sure. I don't think about how often which the word is trust. They trust the book. They just buy the book. They're not looking for a review. They're looking for my name, and they know they can nail it. And a lot of the writers write that when they write the Amazon reviews, you know.
Have you ever had writer's block? Have you ever had where you just couldn't? Have there ever been days where you couldn't write?
No, I don't have those days. Thank goodness. You know, there are writers who say they have writer's block. I don't know what writer's block is. You got to sit down. You got to, you know, plant your butt in a seat. And if you're thinking out, you're not having a good day, you will have a good day, because you got to sit there, and you're not going to get up until it starts to flow. I mean, it may be days, I guess, when something is happening of, you know, monumental importance in your life, or you might have a little bit of a hangover, let's say. But the idea is to sit there, and it will come. It will always come. And there's a million excuses to get up from the writer's chair and do something else. And people take those excuses, and they say, I just can't. I don't have it today. Somebody invented something called writer's block, and I've got it. But that's not true. You write for a living. If you got writer's block, you're in the wrong business.
That's true. I'm sure you were in much more frightening conditions when you were in the Army. I'm sure you have many stories like that. Will you ever write a book about those experiences? I mean, a nonfiction book about that?
You know, that's a good question. I would like to, but I don't think there's a lot of publishers who... It would have to have the kind of angle that, what was his name, did in Goodbye Darkness, was it Manchester? He wrote about returning to the South Pacific, where he fought in World War II, the island hopping campaign. It was really an incredible book. I mean, something like that. I did go back to Vietnam in 97.
Did you ever get shot?
I wasn't wounded by rifle fire, but I was wounded by shrapnel. But light wounds. I mean, really light wounds.
Right.
You know, nothing that you couldn't do yourself with a razor, you know, by mistake. You know, but shaving kind of cuts, a little cut across my forehead, that type of thing. But getting shot at is a life-altering experience, and it's hard to capture it. But you know, yeah, I'd like to do a nonfiction book while I'm still. You know, well, I still remember, but it would need some kind of an impetus. It would need the idea of the publisher needs to believe in the book too, because fiction writers who try to write nonfiction, it's not always a pleasant thing for the publisher. They're looking for you to do what you do best.
It's like when comedy people in movies try to do drama, it doesn't always work. You're so used to the comedy.
And it's the fans that are used to you doing X, Y, or Z. It's not, you know, maybe you have it in you to do it, but the people around you, the producers and the editors, and you know, and then ultimately the fans are saying, you know, this is not what I'm looking for in Nelson DeMille. But I think if I wrote something like a memoir, honestly, it might not achieve bestseller stature, but it might be a good thing for me to do at this stage of my life.
Now, where did you meet up with Thomas Buck? He's the one that helped you write May Day.
Right, yeah. Tom and I met when we were 5 years old. We lived down the street from each other in a brand new suburban neighborhood, a post-war neighborhood in Long Island and Elmont.
Oh.
And we've been friends since we were five, and he and I flew together for a while. And he became a commercial airline pilot at 19 years old, and he's a good writer. So he wrote about his novels are I guess what you call airline disaster novels. But he writes a lot of nonfiction magazine articles. So it was just a natural that he and I would team up to do this airline disaster novel, May Day, which was actually made into a CBS TV movie back about 10 years ago with Aidan Flynn.
Aidan Flynn, yeah.
Aidan Quinn.
He's in that show, Elementary, now.
Right, yeah. And it was a good movie. It was CBS TV. It was during Sweeps Weeks in October, I remember, and it did very well, the ratings. I wanted to see a feature film, but it was a good TV movie. It's a classical airline disaster novel, and he was the guy I needed to write it. I mean, I asked people for help with researching, but this was so intense. The technology was so intense. I needed a co-author. And it's the only time I've ever co-authored, and I don't think I would do it again. It was a tough experience for both of us.
Right. Now, will we see any more movies with John Corey or Paul Brenner?
We're working on something now with Columbia Motion Pictures owns The Lion's Game.
What is that? Which is one of your best.
Thank you. That's a Corey. And they did own Plum Island, which was the first Corey book. But
another great one.
That was, I think, one of the best of the Corey, the first one. Just coincidentally. I'm not coincidentally, but ironically, because it was meant to be a standalone book. It was never meant to be.
It was. Those two books are just phenomenal.
And they would make good movies. And Columbia Sony is still working on it. They're trying to get an angle on it. The problem with Hollywood is they don't like to make anti-terrorist movies because, you know, the political correctness, perhaps, that you don't want to offend, Arabs in general, Muslims. And I don't think any of these books are offensive. I think they're dealing with a specific issue that has nothing to do with, really, Islam or Muslims. And, but Hollywood's a little bit skittish about it. The irony is they bought the books to make it the movies and then had second thoughts about it. But we're also working with, we're talking to HBO and TNT about making a series sort of like Homeland.
Wow, very cool.
They're a lot more open to this because the issues of Islamic terrorism don't bother them at all because their audience is American, whereas the feature film audience, about half of it these days is foreign, foreign distribution in Europe and Asia.
There's a lot to consider.
They have a lot more to consider, but yeah. TV is different than that. Cable TV is doing some really incredible things. The production quality is much better. The rating is
great. Yeah.
So I'm okay with that. I wasn't okay with it 10 years ago, but now I'm okay with a TV series on the John Corey books.
Right, exactly. I like Homeland, but I don't like the main character. I have trouble warming up to him. He's quite cold.
Yeah. I get kind of hot and cold on this. Everybody loves it. I'm trying to think, is this me or is it?
Right, that's exactly how I feel. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. I'm not sure, some of it seems too contrived, just too cool for school, and some parts were, a genius, and like anything else, it gets tired after a while. Everybody who's in the entertainment business, whether it be performing arts or writing books, you got to be careful that your character doesn't get tired. You don't get tired. Maybe Homeland might be getting. Seems to have the energy. I'm not sure. I need to go back to it. I kind of gave it up.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through the first season, and everybody's trying to get me to watch it again. And I don't know. For some reason, it doesn't stay with me as much as I wanted to.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and that's the way I felt. I just had a conversation with somebody the other day. But I'm talking to TV people. Homeland is what I've got to say because that's what everybody pays attention to. I say it as though I'm a huge fan of Homeland, but I'm not a huge fan. It's not a bad show, but I think the Corey series could be in some ways better.
I think so, too.
That's what they're thinking, too. So, I mean,
And Corey has more of a sense of humor, which I like.
Yeah, it's not as maybe as grim, and also I think more people could relate to a regular. like a regular guy that we could really relate to in a situation that is a little bit esoteric for him, a little bit exotic.
And how old is John Corey, by the way, at this point?
Well, that's a good question.
Do we know? I mean, can we figure it out?
Well, we're trying to keep him young. He's probably, I'd like to think late 40s, but I'm sure he's older than that. But the problem with any serious character is you try to keep them as young as you can. Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective, a Belgian, when he died, the New York Times estimated he was 103 years old.
No wonder he died.
Right, exactly. Well, and everybody who creates a series, whether you know, with the Sherlock Holmes or whatever, you know, time marches on, the internal chronology of the book and the chronology of the main characters got to stay.
Right.
Pretty much early 50s, latest. After that, people don't want to, you know, don't want to hear about them.
Well, you're such a legend in writing, and I will never stop reading your books because I just enjoy every single one of it. I've kept you way over more than I should. Your publicist is probably going to kill me, but it's every minute of this has been a pleasure for me.
No, I'm good, Dave. This is a great interview. I thank you for it. I'm just sitting here having a cup of coffee and wish I could be there with you. I like to do the tours and the,
oh, that's nice.
You know, in studio, and last night I did a TV show from the studio, and it's kind of fun. I'm glad it's compartmentalized, though. And,
right.
Right after the new year, I'm going to get back to the writing, and hopefully the next book will be out in the spring of 2014, so it'll be 18 months.
Oh, wonderful. Now we know exactly when to look for it.
Yeah.
assuming everything goes the way it should.
Assuming everything goes right, and I think I've got a good handle on this one, so we're shooting for, well, like May or...
Well, I can hardly wait.
14. Well, I'll send you an advance reading copy long before then. Hopefully we'll have advance.
Oh, will you really? I'm going to hold you to that.
If you just tell the publicist mailing address, we can get it to you, no problem.
Oh, wow.
I have a list for advance reading copies that I keep for a whole, you know, for the whole time that I'm doing a book. So I know I'm organized like that.
You have a great publicist. He's a great guy. Really easy to talk to. And that's really important.
He's good, and everybody I work with at Grand Central has been good. And I'm organized. I like the fact that I'm organized. I'm not a flighty, you know, guy. I mean, I know what I'm doing in terms of the writing, but also in terms of the publicity. I have lists of, you know, shows that I've done and things that have gone well and things that have not gone well. And I keep my list of who gets the advance reading copies. I keep it for as long as it takes to write the book.
So, right. And that's, you know, great. That's,
yeah,
just...
yeah, unfortunately, this is part of what you do today. It's social media, too, is something new. But you can't just write the book and put it out there and in the front window of a store downtown like you did 50 years ago. Now it's a whole different world. And,
oh, well, I'm sure they keep you on your toes. I'm sure there are days you're like, I wish I could just go back to bed.
But when you're up at 5 in the morning, well, you're probably up early too, but some of these shows, the publicity tour of 12, 13, 14 cities can be grinding, but I did it when I was younger, and it was an adventure, but now I kind of try to avoid the 14-city cross-country tour.
Right. Well, I am totally honored that you took the time to talk to me. And the book, again, is called The Panther. It's out from Grand Central Press. And it's been an absolute delight. I can't thank you enough for this.
David, thank you so much for the opportunity. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Then this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you again. Thanks.